So for those of you who were not here last time, naughty students, try to download and listen to last week's talk. It's very easy to do on the website.
Did you make a
signal? I did.
It's still very small.
Since darshan, things have gotten better, and so I noticed that the last two Savitri presentations and the last evolution presentation have brought together a lot of things. So, if you have time, have a listen to that. So we are winding up. We have a couple of more sessions, and we're moving in the direction of supermind. We're going to try to make a transition from mind to supermind in the philosophy of evolution. Sri Aurobindo says a clever thing there. It is here necessary, in a matter so remote from the ordinary lines of our thought and experience, to state first what is the universal gnosis or divine supermind. So that's not what I'm going to read right now. But we will read that tonight. The question that we ended up with last time, and we've ended with that question a few times over the last 25 sessions or whatever it has been, do we need to have some understanding, some theory, other than the theories that the philosophy and science of evolution have given us so far? And we've reviewed many such theories. And I think we've learned a lot. We can probably visualize what evolution means as far as human beings understand it. We should be able to visualize it pretty easily. We have surveyed repeatedly what could be called structural evolution. We know so much about the evolution of the structures of living things. And that's mainly what Darwinian evolutionary theory is about. And we know so much about the evolution of functions, mobility, food gathering, perception, orientation, survival, child rearing, habitation building, associating with others for the sake of enjoyment, habitual, that the habitual nature of the behavior of living things, And we have also, if we go to the next level, structure, function, purpose, we know a lot about why structures and functions, for what end they work the way they do. And we can measure very precisely, and biologists do this all the time these days, how efficient animal behavior is and insect behavior is, and how precisely even the brain interprets visual imagery. And we know that all of these structures and functions, as Aristotle said 2,400 years ago, are for a purpose. And it seems that nothing that has evolved has been literally by chance. Everything is determined by the constraints of what has already evolved, the constraints of the environment, and the pressures that bring about the necessity for a particular change along a particular pathway. That's with regard to the speciation of creatures. But even internally, when the embryo develops, it develops under genetic, epigenetic, and behavioral pressures for its purposes, according to the body plan and the potentiality of the species. So when Aristotle says that we know the forms of things, we know the essence of things, he means that the mind is able to focus on structures and forms and patterns of behavior and derive exactly what they are, why they are, and for what purpose. And so he could say, in nature, the definition of nature is that nothing happens without a purpose in nature. Nature is that entity, that energy, that process of life that happens for a purpose.
But can't you then say, if nature and life, what is the life that isn't natural?
Yeah. You can say life.
Life
happens for a purpose.
Life happens for a purpose.
Yeah. And the purposes for which life happens are also well known, mostly generation, self-replication, growth, stability, enjoyment, survival. And then when we survey all the examples that we have, paleontological and biological and zoological and ethological, Lawrence's study of the behaviors of animals and how they pass on traits to each other through behavior and not just genetics, and that the behavior of animals is quite parallel to our behavior in almost every way. We just add a kind of veneer of value to the things that we do, but we ritualize everything the way animals do, and we mostly do what animals do until we get to the point of abstracting and planning and designing and all of the things that we understand to be the higher functions of the mind. And when we see that emerging on that long pathway of the evolution of life, when we see mind really emerging as the dominant evolutionary force in humanity, Then we see those things that we identify more precisely with mind, such as ethical behavior. The human being is more social than every other species, than any other species, and its fundamental trait is that it is capable of delaying gratification for the well-being of the group. So once we recognize the emergence of that pattern, whether it's at a tribal archaic level or at a magical or mythical or religious or rational level, we just see increasing sophistication and complexity of what is characteristically human, which is basically rational behavior. There are undoubtedly all kinds of irrational things mixed in, but the fundamental patterns that we observe are predominantly rational in human societies. Yeah, even killing each other. Highly rational behavior. Yeah, and one of the reasons for that is that we are not free-ranging animals. We require a stable habitat. And because we require a stable habitat over a long period of generations in order to be successful, we must secure those habitats against others who would encroach upon them. And even at this point, when the human species is capable of global cooperation, we still have a kind of vestigial interest in securing habitat. So the Bush Doctrine, which was published in 2001, I believe, was it or 2002? It said something like, "We will protect any country in the world who agrees to allow us to use its resources. But any country in the world which doesn't allow us, we have the unilateral right to conquer." And this is written in a document that is called the National Security Strategy of the United States.
But that means nowadays wars are not just fought to maintain our habitat, but for resources that other people.
Well, our habitat now, by definition, is the globe.
Everybody that has what we want.
But then that's good, because it means if you look at what Obama has been doing in China and in India, and it's getting friendly. You know, it's like, for the most part, it's cooperative now, and India depends upon this this brand or this species of ethical behavior that is manifested by Americans, although it's a very different species of ethical behavior than the one that's practiced by Indians. But they recognize in each other qualities that both need. And the idea of Auroville is that all of the more sophisticated cultures of the world would come together and learn to appreciate each other's uniqueness. And only by being exposed to a complex differential pattern is it possible to perceive unity. Otherwise, it's uniformity that you perceive or that you want. But if you really see that all the different subspecies of humanity whose behaviors are so different are manifesting principles that are the same across the board. They just have their own cultural and traditional way of manifesting those principles. Suddenly you understand the meaning of unity. And it doesn't mean that everyone has to do it the same way. It means that the more differently people do it, the more one it can be.
And the more likely evolution can happen.
Yes, exactly. At this point. That wasn't always the case. I mean, it was necessary for cultures to combat each other in order for certain traits to have an opportunity to survive and integrate and so on. But now we're at a different stage of evolution. And when we look at this schemata, we've recognized that the fundamental characteristics of all living behavior and all of these evolutionary stages, if we can reduce them to fundamental principles, on a physical level, they can all be reduced to processes of energy transfer, dissipation of energy, in order to maintain the stability of a form. We keep consuming, but we continue to be what we are, who we are. And so throughout nature we see that that's a characteristic of life. Then we also can see that all life is interested in replicating itself. And even in the individual, we are constantly replicating ourselves. Our cells are doing that all the time. We are autopoietic, self-making. And all species make themselves in the relationship with other species and the environment. And then this whole process of energy transfer, organization of energy for the sake of maintaining and reproducing, constitutes cognition, cognitive processes. Every transfer of energy constitutes a bit of information. So every movement of every living thing is at the same time evaluating its relationship to its environment, spatially, for example, and evaluating its own level of energy and how much it needs to acquire and where it's going to acquire it. And so what we call logical rational behavior is on another level of energy transfer through our neurons, giving us information about our inner and outer environment. And that flow of neurons is that dissipating energy process that is highly focused and organized and conservative. So, when we look at this picture, and we notice that today we have problems of survival, that in the last 100 years the population, which never got larger than 1 billion up until 1800, became 2 billion in 1920, and between 1920 and 2000 became 6 billion. And everyone can look at an exponential population graph that shows humanity going like this for a million years, and then suddenly within 100 years it shoots up 6 times higher than it ever was before. Mathematically, as well as socio-politically, if we look at the 20th century, we can see that the rational mind, which has characterized the whole evolution of the human species, and which is capable of absolutely incredible things, which Sri Aurobindo narrates in the third section of that canto called The Triple Soul Forces, how incredible the spirit of knowledge has manifested in the human being just in the last 100 years, and made available information and technology that would never have been dreamed by any human being ever prior to the 20th century. And so, in spite of that, and because we can see this continuum of evolution for 3 billion years, and if we look at it genetically, the continuum is absolutely unquestionable, we come to the conclusion that something else needs to be possible. Another stage needs to be reached in consciousness, because the rational mind can't figure it out at this point. It is using too much energy to reproduce itself, and its information is not enabling it to balance itself and its environment and the other species on Earth. And so in the last 30 years, 25% of vertebrate species have become extinct. In the last 30 years, vertebrate species, those are our cousins. So we're in the midst of what is known as a mass extinction event. And there have been about 6 of these in known history. Minor ones plus, you know, another bunch of other minor ones, but 6 major ones in the history of life for the last 3 billion years. So just information that's available to us, even without visionaries like Henri Bergson and Sri Aurobindo, we come to the conclusion that the rational, ethical mind can't solve all of its problems. So either we evolve, or we head towards extinction. There is no longer any question about that. It's not something that people think about every day, but it's very easy for anybody to think about it, because there is an enormous amount of information that's available, and it's constantly being updated.
But there are those, unfortunately, large elements of humanity there which are not seeking anything more than to take care of themselves in their environment, to give themselves wealth as they understand wealth.
Yeah, right.
And they couldn't care less about.
And think about that. That is exactly the principle that has enabled societies to exist for thousands of years. So it's well established, a well established principle. It's been viable for a very long time. And you have other behavior patterns that are reversions, to revert to the mythical and the religious, and to jack up revelation, you know, and end of the world, we're going to all reach judgment day and pass into the next sphere, and the United States is full of that one, and the Islamic version, which is we may as well go to the other side because it's better than this one, and if we can take a few with us, why not, you know. And you know, on down the line, you know, there are people who revert back to nature, and we're going to minimize our footprint and get ready, you know, stockpile our goods and find a nice safe place to live, and maybe we will be the flag bearers of the new species if we can just figure out a safe way to survive the Armageddon. And I mean, there are all kinds of strange ways that people have of trying to come to terms with something that science and philosophy understand very well and very rationally. And so there are plenty of people working on solutions. Solar energy and global cooperation and climate change reduction and population control, and all of these good ideas are being understood and implemented on a large scale. We have the Copenhagen conference coming up exactly for that purpose. It started in 91, especially with the Rio summit. The idea that the primary responsibility of nations is to preserve the biosphere. But population continues to go full speed ahead. Pollution continues to go full speed ahead. Extinction rates continue to rise full speed ahead. And so even though the rational mind understands all of these things, somehow it's not able to really make the difference. In fact, if it reflects a little bit, it finds out that it's the problem. So then, philosophically, we've been exploring that at length. Bergson's critique of Aristotle dovetails with Sri Aurobindo's ideas completely. He says that the problem is that, yes, as Aristotle said, the mind knows forms. It can't know the matter of things. It can only know the essences and definitions of things. And then it tries to know and define everything. And it uses all of that information to create its technology and to, you know, make itself more comfortable and powerful and all of that. That's what the mind does. And then Bergson says, but actually, what the mind knows is not the reality of things or the truth of things. It's just a mental representation of things that it uses for its own purposes. And so we don't really know what evolution is and what's driving evolution. And if we think about things that have evolved in a modular sense, sight, vision, we see everything perfectly. That's amazing. It's not the structure of the eyeball which sees things. We have sight. Everything has sight. We have language. There's no way to explain language as such. I mean, you can find structural patterns that make you think that you've understood something about language. But in fact, language is a human ability that enables us to share ideas which exist nowhere, the invisible spiritual realm of understanding is conveyed through language in a way that we all understand, and we haven't the vaguest idea of how that happens to work. You can't explain that in terms of structure or function or purpose, although it has structure and it has function and it has purpose. But it's language. And so the mystical inclination in human beings is to realize that what actually exists, what is itself quite extraordinary. And this thing of this subject of evolution, if we look at it over 3 billion years, at this extraordinary phenomenon of nature, and the fact that there is purpose, the fact that there is function, that things function for a purpose, the fact that there are structures that systematically serve functions and purposes, the fact that this globe is made of consciousness is itself an amazing fact that is not explained by any of those structures, functions, and behaviors, and so on. So Sri Aurobindo then makes this inference. He says, this amazing phenomenon of consciousness that is evolving from the one-celled organism that is cognitive of its environment to the most aesthetically refined human being, this evolution of consciousness couldn't be a product of quanta of energy. It couldn't be a product of life force. It couldn't be a product of the rational intelligence, because the rational intelligence can hardly understand anything, even though it's very clever and practical. So this whole phenomenon of consciousness is so vast and incredibly intricate and incomprehensible when you get right down to it, that there must be another principle of consciousness greater than mind, life, and physical structure, body, matter, that was there from the beginning and makes it possible that there will be a next stage, that that original consciousness force is the secret source of all of these patterns and functions and behaviors, and it will emerge in itself at its own level of quality, which he said is so as different from the human rational mind as the human rational mind is different from the ordinary beast in the forest. So if you take the fact, if we take the fact that in the last 150 years, the science of evolution has itself evolved. None of these things were known. And in fact, the genetic continuity of species wasn't known until the 60s. The idea of Mendelian inheritance wasn't integrated into evolutionary theory until the 40s. Yeah, the principle of inheritance was integrated in the 40s, but the continuum of the biomolecular continuum of the genome wasn't known in the 40s. It has required highly sophisticated scientific instruments to observe it, and only since the 80s has it really been securely known, that we can look at any species bone, any bone marrow from any period of time and find out exactly where that entity fits into the whole structure. If we put together, let's say, Bergson and Sri Aurobindo's consciousness in 1910, their totally synthetic, highly mystically inspired consciousness, full of everything that was known at that time about evolution, we can put one and one together here. We can see how Bergson and Sri Aurobindo were able to integrate this worldview of evolution and the spiritual view of transcendence and integrate them completely and say, The real driving force in evolution is the higher consciousness, and it has been moving everything along the will of the spirit, is the essential thing behind every movement, and it itself will emerge at some point in a form that is its full embodiment. Everything else along the way is temporary, partial, and eventually it will have a form of its own as a result of structural evolution.
Your question, if the creation is perfect from the beginning and total of all, what is then the reason that still evolution is needed?
Nothing was perfect from the beginning. And nothing is perfect now. And supermind is not manifested. It's a potential. Sri Aurobindo says that when the universe was created, supermind was a potential in matter. Life was a potential in matter, and mind was a potential in matter. And time and space are necessary for the eventual emergence in form of supermind. No perfection along the way, only imperfection to be exceeded by better imperfection or worse imperfection or whatever. So now, I'm going to just skim through some of Sri Aurobindo's statements about this. I recommend that you read this chapter called The Nature of the Supermind, chapter 19. You're fascinated by these insects. Huh? So listen to this. This is what I just said, but I was trying to put it in our context. So, it will be evident that though the supermind is supra-rational to our intelligence, and its workings occult to our apprehension, it is nothing irrationally mystic, but rather its existence and emergence is a logical necessity of the nature of existence, because mind cannot emerge from inconscient matter. It has to have been there before, and inconscient matter can't emerge from nothing. So spirit had to be there before matter. Provided we grant that not matter or mind alone, but spirit is the fundamental reality, and everywhere a universal presence. All things are a manifestation of the infinite spirit out of its own being. Out of its own consciousness and by the self-realizing, self-determining, self-fulfilling power of that consciousness. The infinite, cannot possibly be embodied, cannot be seen, cannot be known, infinite. We may say, organizes by the power of its self-knowledge. And that doesn't mean our kind of self-knowledge. It means knowledge by the self. Inherent knowing. By the power of its self, knowing itself as itself, by that, the law of its own manifestation of being in the universe, not only the material universe present to our senses, but whatever lies behind it on whatever planes of existence, all is organized by it, not under any inconscient compulsion, not according to a mental fantasy or caprice, but in its own infinite spiritual freedom according to the self-truth of its being, its infinite potentialities, and its will of self-creation out of those potentialities. And the law of this self-truth is the necessity that compels created things to act and evolve, each according to its own nature. The intelligence, to give it an inadequate name, the logos, the supermind, that thus organizes its own manifestation in time and space, and under all the contingencies of time and space, under the contingencies of imperfection, because time and space imply imperfection. You can't have change if you don't have imperfection. So there can be no time if you don't have imperfection. Organizes its own manifestation, not the manifestation of itself as such, but its own manifestation of what is, everything that is, which is not itself, but which is of itself. Is evidently something infinitely greater, more extended in knowledge, compelling in self-power, large both in the delight of its self-existence and the delight of its active being and works than the mental intelligence, which is to us the highest realized degree and expression of consciousness. Our sense mind, our rational mind, that's what we think of as consciousness. But Sri Aurobindo says, this universe and this planet and this extraordinary phenomenon of conscious evolution is so infinitely more complex in its power and its knowledge that we cannot possibly even begin to conceive of how everything really works. It is, to this intelligence, infinite in itself, but freely organizing and self-determiningly organic in its self-creation and its works, that we may give for our present purpose the name of the divine supermind or gnosis. Now, the transformation of consciousness that Sri Aurobindo is suggesting as the next stage of evolution is that. Then, for our purposes, we need to know how.
Do we need to know how several thousand years ago, or have we ever needed
No, we only how? Need to know now. We only need to know now. A thousand years ago, we needed to know how to think logically. And a thousand years before that, we needed to know how to respect kings.
When our sight evolved, or our ability to digest certain things evolved, it didn't evolve because we were thinking about how to help it evolve.
No, it didn't. It evolved because of the inner impulsion of the self nature of existence.
So now we're rising out of that.
And into what is the question? And so Bergson and Sri Aurobindo have made it absolutely crystal clear the difference between mental understanding and supramental understanding is that mental understanding knows things outside that it represents to itself and analyzes. Supramental understanding knows everything from inside, in its energy. Everything outside is inside. We don't realize that, but that's the idea. And only when we stop looking outside and depending on sight and sound and inference, and surrender in a particular way to a descending power of consciousness force, can we begin to learn to know from inside the thing which is outside. And it's not representational or analytical, it is immediate and total identity. Then the identity of things is no longer in relation to our personality. Our personality is gone. Listen to this. The yoga of perfection necessary to this change. It's not going to come about by itself. So far as we have understood it, so far as we have been considering it, consisted, and we've had several chapters about the nature of mind and what's necessary in order to transition ourselves out of our normal mentality into this other type of knowing. So far as we've understood that, consists in a preparatory purification of the mental, vital, and physical nature. Our habits of thinking, our habits of needing, our dependencies. Then, a liberation from the knots of the lower prakriti, the movements in us that are so evolutionarily established that we cannot function without them, we think, to liberate ourselves from those patterns of habitual behavior, after purifying the existing patterns of habitual behavior, then liberating ourselves from them, a consequent replacement of the egoistic state, always subject to the ignorant and troubled action of the desire soul, replacement of that by a large and luminous static equality which quiets the reason, which quiets the emotional mind. Reason and emotional mind, those are the two levels of our mentality. Quiets the life mind, the habitual maintenance of our well-being mind, and quiets the physical nature, and brings into us the peace and freedom of the spirit. And a dynamical substitution of the action of the supreme and universal divine Shakti, the force in the plant, the force in the gods, the force in the all the intermediary visible and invisible beings, the force itself becomes a dynamical carrier of our action, our thought, our behavior, our response, and all of those habitual things that we identify as ourselves vanish. Transformation. Under the control of the will, the essential will of being itself, not something outside in some other world, the essential will of being itself in us and in everything controls the divine consciousness force, Chit Shakti, and that has the power to do what our mind does better than our mind could ever do it, to do what our life does better than our life can ever do it, and to even transform our physical body into something very close to immortality. An action, a dynamical action of the divine Shakti through us, when all of those other layers are removed and replaced by a static equality. No reaction to anything. No impulse to anything. But everything in us and the will that makes everything be what it is in us can move us an action whose complete operation, there can be a partial, incomplete operation of it, but whose complete operation must be preceded by the perfection of the natural instruments, mind, life, and body. So this is the dialectic of transformation between the ordinary functioning of the instruments, the static equality, and the transformation of the instruments by that other resource that is available if we would but let it act. This is Sri Aurobindo's metaphysical, yogic integration of the philosophy of evolution and the possibility of spiritual transformation. And according to him, this is the key to the human predicament. And all of that other stuff, all that patching up of things, is just a temporary patching up of things. It's not going to be enough. Yeah, it means the silencing and purifying of the mind and the life force and the surrendering of the self.
Step one. You take the rest of our lives and many lifetimes.
And he said in the Life Divine, where he's discussing these things, he says, An essential first step for that, for us to be able to do that, is for us to put ourselves in direct contact with the divine reality. That means the mother's force. If one doesn't find a way to do that, then all of this is out of the question, basically. Yeah, okay, so a momentous question arises. The momentous question that arises is, can this be done by the mind? Is it to be always through the mind only, on the mind plane, or in some greater supramental formulation which is more proper to a divine action? If the mind is to be always the instrument, then although we shall be conscious of a diviner power initiating and conducting all our inner and outer human action, yet it will have to formulate its knowledge, will, ananda, and all things else in the mental figure. And that means to translate them into an inferior kind of functioning other than the supreme workings native to the divine consciousness and its shakti. So we spend a lot of time trying to understand and receive and visualize and transmit this potential divine shakti mentally. That gets us a certain way up the ladder, but that's it. So he says in the Life Divine, even if we transcend mind completely into illumined mind and intuitive mind, it still isn't going to change anything. It's just a higher mind, a more luminous vision. But the world keeps on happening, life keeps on happening the way it happens. So the opening of the higher levels of mind is a necessary process. But then he says, even that illumined intuitive mind has to abdicate to the supermind. And that supermind has to build in us an instrument for action and energy and knowledge which is superior to the highest spiritualized mind. It's another way of being. And he says that we cannot know by any level of mind. And although we have to go up that ladder of universalizing and depersonalizing and illumining this mental instrument, still that's not it. So then he says, the mind spiritualized, purified, liberated, perfected within its own limits, may come as near as possible to a faithful mental translation. But we shall find that this is, after all, a relative fidelity and an imperfect perfection. The mind, by its very nature, cannot render with an entirely right rightness or act in the unified completeness of the divine knowledge, will, and ananda, because it is an instrument for dealing with the divisions of the finite on the basis of division. A secondary instrument, therefore, it isn't capable of the dynamic unity of the all in us and us in the all, because it puts up this dividing screen and represents its knowledge, and it's an instrument that has evolved, but its work doesn't have much of a future.
Would it recognize the evolved?
Absolutely.
How?
Because the higher mind and the illumined mind has vision, truth vision.
No, this mind, the mind that dwells...
This rational mind? No, probably not. But, you know, with... In my experience, with the mother, for example, it was possible to see that that luminosity and rapidity and accuracy and delight that she was manifesting wasn't ordinary, but it was not possible to understand what it was. So for me personally, I witnessed it a number of times, and I could never even recall its quality from one time to the next. It was so other than my experience. But it was what it was. And that in itself is something indicative of what's being spoken about. And I'm sure people had the same kind of experience with Sri Aurobindo. You read about it, you know. And
but then also, all these levels of mind, there are levels within mind, and it's not like there are barriers in between.
It's a fluid transition.
So it's possible to kind of flow into that, even for a split second, if you're in the presence
It's possible to live in that. So Sri Aurobindo says, if you are secure in the higher mind, you have achieved what is the goal of most spiritual traditions. So you can recognize in a Zen master that universality of knowledge and balance and sympathy and compassion, and you know that that person has stabilized in that higher mind realm. And that's a wonderful thing. That constitutes liberation. Sri Aurobindo is saying this liberation is just a step along the way. And what really has to happen in terms of evolution is that that supreme all nature of things has itself to descend into the mental, vital, physical instrument and begin to build there its instrumentation.
I would suggest that it's already there. And
yeah, sure.
The ability to recognize.
Yeah, sure.
And the role of faith, that irrational, mind-boggling thing.
Yeah, well, the previous chapter to this one, is called Faith and Shakti. When you're in touch with that force, not just mentally, but when you're really in touch with its potentiality, and your mind begins to dissolve in a universal appreciation of, for example, force manifesting in all of these civilizations and beings, and consciousness manifesting in all of these individuals and groups, and you're seeing things and knowing things in terms of consciousness and force, and you're feeling that as being a universal, infinite potentiality, then you must have faith that it can build its instrument. But if you're not that much in touch with it, if you don't fulfill that first requirement that Sri Aurobindo says is necessary to put yourself in touch with that reality itself, if you haven't found a way to do that, either through someone like the mother or through Savitri or through your own inner contact, then your faith is not dynamic. But there is a point where you become so conscious of that infinite potential in all of its little imperfect manifestations that you give up judging and you have faith that that can work more directly through you and your relationships and in all of these temporal imperfections, and you surrender to it. But that's a come and go thing for a long time, because we keep getting pulled back into our sense of right and wrong and our preferences and our doctrinal understanding of things and how it is and how it's supposed to be and what she said and... It blows the mind.
Doubt tries to gather the pieces back together.
That's exactly right. And habit. Just habit, even without doubt.
What is the sense then from learning this?
Well, the sense is that as we've learned in evolution, in our philosophy of evolution course, for the human being, for quite a few thousand years now, evolution's primary instrument has been speech. And we only know these things because Sri Aurobindo took the trouble to formulate them in a particularly powerful and dynamic way at the same time that he was cultivating receptivity to them. And so those who are able to hear, let them hear. And those who are able to see, let them see. Because that's how human culture evolves. And Bergson is very brilliant with his survey of history and how great mystics who have achieved liberation and union from time to time throughout history have brought that force itself into the current status of social relations and norms and understanding and given them an impetus that has carried things forward for another period of history, and that all, according to him, all along the way of human evolution, there have been these descents, these avatars, that haven't come from a tradition. They have brought into the tradition a whole new energy and possibility. And Bergson says now, in this is in the 1930, he says now in this age of science and technology, when that mystical union occurs, it will bring a force of consciousness into the current level of human development that will enable the human being to transcend itself.
Yeah. What about the human being now so conscious and hopefully going to be conscious, even becoming involved in its own evolution?
That's exactly the point.
Yeah.
That's why we're doing a course in the philosophy of evolution. I've said it 100 times. Can we become evolutionary beings.
Yes.
Can our being evolutionary be enhanced by our effort of understanding in this way nature?
Well, that answers Martin's question.
Or is it just another mental game that we play?
In order to become more conscious of the whole process and to participate in it more consciously.
But we could easily just take this as another mental exercise. Now we've understood something about Sri Aurobindo, now we've understood something about Darwin, and so then we just go on about our business as usual. That's possible.
You know, there are things required of us to do this, the purification of mind and body, faith. I mean, there are actions, there are things that we must
absolutely
participate in. It's not going to happen just sitting in a classroom.
And riding a bus around the Mantra Mandir.
Right. That's why the pedals.
There's something more that's possible. And it's possible that the evolution takes place gradually over a long period of time without human effort. But Sri Aurobindo said very clearly, it can take a millennium. This new force is going to manifest. It can take a millennium. Or it can go very quickly in relation to this process of yoga.
You said that the evolution can go without human effort. It's a mistake.
I didn't say that.
No, the one phrase before. No, it is.
No, the fact that human effort has already been made to bring down the supramental force means that that supramental force is working, and the question is whether the human being will enhance it and amplify it and deliberately raise it to its full capacity, or will it just gradually improve the mental. Sri Aurobindo says that's also a possibility, that it can come to a point where mind itself is illumined and human civilization becomes a kind of semi-transformed type of society, type of being, the Superman. Or will the supramental evolve its own instrumentation through human sacrifice, human self-giving, human transformation to the point which Savitri is all about, where death becomes the bridge to reincarnation on a quantum level of difference from the normal pattern of rebirth. In the Buddhist system, the goal of reincarnation is to come back with compassion for the realization of others of liberation and compassion. Sri Aurobindo says that's not enough. That's fine, that's going to keep going on, it's always been going on, but it doesn't change anything. So the idea of Savitri is that that force enters into the mortal and prepares the mortal before death of every experience that normally happens after death. And then when death occurs, it is a direct synthesis and rebirth on a level which is a quantum difference from the human. That's what Savitri is about.
But we use a lot of language, because in Western mode of speaking, we are trying to say open a gate and something comes from above. It's a one way. There's another way, which is mother's way, is from inside. So India always had a
But the two things are complementary.
Of course.
They can't happen without each other.
Yes.
The psychic being, Sri Aurobindo explains in great detail that the opening from inside is only for the purpose of creating a base for that descent.
Yes.
So they're not two different ways.
Yes, yes. But in ego is an enemy. So it's mother who's doing yoga in us.
Right.
From start. And simply,
and mother means the divine Shakti.
Yes.
The force.
And this is a problem of how to unite and how to cooperate.
Yes. Self-giving.
It is all of the
sacrifice. I said the human sacrifice.
The ethical behavior.
It's not a sacrifice. The sacrifice means you lose something.
No, that's wrong understanding.
Sacrifice in yoga means giving yourself to a purpose which entails excluding other things. So you give up your ordinary things to become open to that thing. And that is a sacrifice.
Why do they use the word sacrifice? The traditional Western religion sacrifice, you know, fire, don't eat fish, and the sacrifice...
Because that's religion. That's religion.
I know.
But in yoga, it's never been like that. In yoga, sacrifice has always meant purification in the flame of transformation. That's what sacrifice means. And the outer thing is a symbol of that. The candle, the incense, and the ash, those are symbols of that. But then everyone says that that's the sacrifice. So you... Not eating fish on...
In this passage, we have only a problem of entire process. Because gnosis is a more interesting feature of the whole affair that Sri Aurobindo uses words which have another connotation.
Yes,
Logos,
absolutely.
Gnosis,
yeah.
It's all found in all our tradition. It's negated by mental activity. So we have to recover our own heritage and capture the new impulse. This Gnosis, which is housed into your soul.
Gnosticism had its positive side. But because of its battle with Christianity and all of that, it had a strong negative side.
It had to go underground.
It went underground, yeah. But where did it come from? It came from the Neoplatonic tradition. And people like Iamblichus were able to dematerialize themselves. So it's there in Western tradition. The idea of the Logos as the Christ was true, but human society and human religion and all of that made out of it a kind of tribal institution.
Yeah, private hell. Actually, the problem is that what you say is correct, but using the tools to communicate with us, we can understand the details.
Yes.
And the details are very crucial for our survival today.
And not just crucial for the survival of a culture or a tradition or a religion or a people, but crucial for human survival.
Yes.
That's what Sri Aurobindo says. Now, not everyone believes that, and not everyone needs to believe that, but this is Sri Aurobindo's view. Now, the evolutionary scientists will say, we don't need that principle, that consciousness is there in matter, yes. The universe has evolved consciousness, yes. The ethical mind is a stepping stone, yes. And evolution itself will work out the next step, whatever that is, and it is not necessary to presume that supermind was there from the beginning and that it is the inner will which is driving everything secretly towards this end. They will say, quite correctly, that is not a necessity for understanding evolution. It's a metaphysical add-on to what we know mentally about evolution. But philosophically, we can understand philosophically that that is a mistake, because if mind itself is producing that understanding, it's this rational mind which is the block, which is the thing which has to be surpassed. And if rational mind is a product of matter, then something beyond rational mind must also be a product of matter, if that's not the end. And so you eventually come to the conclusion that supermind, or something beyond mind, is necessary anyway, and if it's possible, it must have been inherent as a potential from the beginning, just like life and mind. So the scientist doesn't want to make that leap, because he doesn't want to bother himself with impractical philosophical speculations. But there's another step up from philosophy, which is into yoga. And then it becomes a practical knowledge which generates energy and inspiration and solutions to problems which that rational ethical mind is not going to generate. So then it becomes a practical necessity for some people to demonstrate the effectiveness of what is beyond mind.
And it's also not necessary to consider whether or not it got into the emotion in the first place.
No, it's not. No, it's just a metaphysical construct. But Sri Aurobindo uses the term necessity. He says that that reality is the reality. And to make this transition requires that we become conscious of that reality as opposed to this reality. And so it's crucial for those who are doing yoga.
But the mind loves to debate, so let's talk about the origin of it, because then the mind can spin its wheels on doubt, and it takes us away from the practice that's now, we can do.
It is very important what we say, but it is exactly the form in which there is an invisible, secret, silent, infinite working without our knowledge. And it is a problem how to open your eyes in internal eyes. And it's a problem how to close up out external eyes. So you have to die to be reborn.
That's the practice.
It's very simple.
It's practice.
Yes.
It's called sadhana.
And you have only two solutions. You have to open the stuff, it's done.
That word complete, that.
So, and we are communicating mentally about something that we actually experience which is outside of our mental sphere. So this is a privilege which we have, knowing these things. We know that we can switch back and forth. Then the problem is to not switch back at some point, and to let just that energy act in itself. And that's the knot.
Outside this mental knowledge, rational knowledge, a lot of, you can say, para-knowledge, isn't it? Mental knowledge is behind the scenes, like a stage, theater, performances, and there's training of actors before the stage is used. So there is a lot of training before the play is gone, the show. So this is most important. We are on the stage. And what's behind it is this curtain, it's most important. Before we open the stage, there's some hard work. Actors are working for days and nights, for months, to prepare a performance. And this is most important.
Every step that we take brings that vibration more into the earth plane. Every practice that we do, every moment of infusion of divine force that we experience brings more into the earth plane. And on a global scale, there are going to be many people who serve, not so many, but there are going to be people who serve that impulse without doing the practice. You know, like when the Dalai Lama came to meet the mother, she said, one of the things she said to him was, when he asked her about the liberation of Tibet, and she said, only when world leaders become open to the new consciousness. And then she said, you can help. And since that time, his influence in international meetings all around the world for the last 40 years, that was 40 years ago that he met her. His influence has been very constant, very present, and it's not the highest supramental, but he's a practitioner, and whenever he's present, there is a kind of spiritual emptiness and compassion that comes in, you know, and it looks like there's a change. We can perceive a change in the quality of leaders. If we look at the Chinese and the Indian and you know the people who are meeting in the world, the American and the German and you know, you can see that these people have smiles on their faces and they're trying to work out some things, okay, and they're not divinely inspired particularly. Some of them may be sometimes, but there is a vibration of unity that's seeping in, and there's an urgency that is pushing from within, you know, there's an occult process going on in the world, which is not really our business, because our business is not the occult process, it is the outer, visible, concrete, yogic enterprise. And I'm not talking about building roads in Oroville.
Why not?
Yeah, why not? If that's what you want to do in your spare. I mean, it wouldn't be bad to have some. But the reason why I said that is because there is something that's going on here which is not about building the infrastructure and the economy and all of that. You know, there's something else that can be going on here. And that's the more important thing. So that's a measure, an outer measure of something which is going on inside. But still what I'm speaking of is something which is going on outside, completely outside. You know, and that's not only here. There are plenty of places in the world where that's a conscious outer aspiration and work. I've seen it and I know it there, but not on the scale of here.
But here I feel in Orville, it's mostly like these world leaders that you're talking about. Most people are somewhat in that attitude. They're sort of open to something, but they're not conscious.
Yeah.
They talk
no, I'm not speaking about most people.
Alternative living and ecology and
yeah.
The other thing is like secondary.
But it's not. The other thing is primary.
Yeah.
And even if it's only one person, for 1 hour, it makes a difference. Your little mind is just clicking away there. You're trying to calculate the percentage of supramental.
Each one is in touch with the sadhana towards that has an exponential impact on the population.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I might be able to put together one more presentation. This is basically the end. But I said last time I would introduce cosmological anthropic principles.